This call is being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, please disconnect at this time.
Welcome and thank you for taking the time to attend the second episode of our webinar series, Beyond Wall Street, Alternative Income Strategies for Accredited Investors. The call today will last 30 minutes. All participants are in a listen-only mode and the line will open up for questions and discussion at the end of the presentation. Today, Jan Bresky and Greg Hebner of Arixa Capital will discuss lending on single-family homes for income. Please refer to the PDF presentation that was emailed earlier this morning. It is also available on our website, arixacapital.com/events. You may email or text Jan Bresky during the call with your questions. Please refer to the email you received earlier today for Jan's contact information. After the discussion, we will unmute the phones so you can ask questions directly. For now, I will hand over the microphone to Jan Bresky.
Good morning, and thank you for joining our second webinar in this series about alternative income strategies. Today, I'm here with my business partner, Greg Hebner, and he's going to be talking about the single-family home lending niche for generating income. The purpose of the series is to explore all kinds of niche strategies for generating income, and I would like to get your questions via text, or you can ask questions at the end. I'm going to give you my cell phone number so anybody can text me at any time with questions if you like. That is 310-428-9109, 310-428-9109. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Greg. Could you give us a little bit of background, Greg, about your experience in real estate investing? And I should just mention, I met Greg 5 years ago approximately when I had started my first fund. And he was a borrower. He was very actively buying houses and rehabbing them. And over time, he has become a partner and the co-manager of our lending fund. So with that, Greg Hebner.
Thanks, John. So I've been investing in real estate, single-family real estate, since I graduated from undergraduate studies. So almost 25 years of investing, primarily until the housing crisis, buying single-family homes, fixing them up and renting them out to families. And with the housing crisis, I was involved working with a large specialty servicing company that was working out a lot of the delinquent loans that were made in 2008 and before. And it allowed me to access some opportunities to purchase REO properties, mostly in coastal California markets, and began to fix those up and resell them. And, completed a couple hundred transactions using that strategy. I met Jan about 5 years ago and was immediately taken by the opportunities to provide capital in a debt capacity in this space. And together we've grown the business to be one of the largest private lenders in California.
Great. So I'm going to ask you, Greg, to give me answers in about 30 seconds so we can keep the ball moving. First of all, describe the core lending strategy that you're pursuing as co-manager of these lending funds.
So our borrowers tend to be professional real estate investors or developers who are seeking quick, short-term financing in a first lien position to help capitalize their projects. Unable to work with banks for a number of reasons we'll probably discuss later, they're looking for reliable financing, willing to pay rates in the 8 to 10% range to access the capital. And we're looking to be, the first call when they're acquiring and renovating primarily single-family or small-unit apartments in desirable coastal California markets.
Terrific. So tell us about a typical loan. We're here in Westwood, California, next to UCLA, and I understand you have a recent loan very close to our office to talk about.
Yeah, so just as an example of a recent transaction, we have a very experienced developer who's probably completed 25 or 30 projects in the LA area. About 3 miles from our location, purchased a three-bedroom, two-bath, 1,500-square-foot home for about $800,000. He added 1,000 square feet, additional bedroom, two bedrooms and bath, and is selling it. He's in contract to sell it for $1,550,000. We lent him 75% of his purchase price and 75% of his rehab, charged him a rate in the mid-nines with a couple points of origination for the year. So our loan to cost on that is about 75% of his purchase and rehab costs, and will be just under 60% of value when it sells this week.
Okay. And what type of net returns are you offering to investors, or have you been delivering to investors, and do you expect this to continue, or do you think that the returns are changing?
Well, our historical returns, we operate two funds together. One is an unlevered fund, which has produced returns in the 8 to 9% range over the last several years. Our levered fund has produced returns in the low 10% range over the last 3 years. We are seeing some compression in the rates and in the pricing, so I think those returns could tick down a little bit in the future. But, you know, I think those are reasonable estimates of kind of where the market is at and, you know, where we're operating the funds right now.
And what's the margin of safety with each investment and with the fund?
So, you know, obviously we're always going to be in a secured position with a deed of trust and collateral on the loans that we make. Typically, our borrowers are seeking to make somewhere between a 10 to 15% profit on their investments in order to even begin to undertake the project. So we're looking to be somewhere in the 55 to 65% of final value, and the borrowers are going to have somewhere between 25 to 35% of cost in a project. So kind of thinking about margin of safety, you know, our loan wants to be, you know, obviously below the profit margin, below all of the borrower's equity in the project, and then us being the first people to be paid back. So, you know, we look at the margin of safety as, you know, how much could the market move during the tenure of our loan, which is usually going to be, you know, 6 to 12 months. They're short-term loans. And markets that historically have not had that kind of volatility, most of the markets in coastal California have tended to move at a slower pace than some of the more outlying markets.
So what you're saying is the market would have to drop approximately how much for you to lose money on a loan if you do your underwriting correctly and there are no flaws or mistakes?
It's somewhere between 35 and 40% of value would need to go down during the time our loan was in place, or if something went wrong, we took the property back in that period of time.
So let's talk about that. What can go wrong, and how do you end up losing money? Because every strategy, especially a strategy that generates these types of returns, is susceptible to losing money. So what would have to go wrong? What mistake are you most worried about making that would cause for there to be a loss on an individual loan or for one of the funds in any given month or quarter or year?
And so I think a couple things. So first of all, you know, I think the way we make our investment decisions, it's kind of old school, but we meet our borrowers, we see their projects. It's a very, very hands-on investment strategy. I think there is a benefit of knowing exactly who you're dealing with and what you're dealing with on every investment that we make. I think the things that I'd be most concerned about, as in any lending strategy, would just simply be fraud and/or, you know, not perfecting your collateral interest on the front end of a loan, making sure that your underwriting is tight, everything is done, documented, and perfected in a way that your collateral is always in place. I think that's the single biggest risk in a lending strategy, is not doing that correctly.
So you're saying the number one risk that keeps you up at night and cause a loss is fraud, mortgage fraud?
Fraud would be the single biggest. If you did that, I think you'd put yourself at the most risk. I think.
So how do you mitigate against that?
Okay, I think there's having very, very strong loan documents, having good underwriting, really checking the boxes and making sure that you've properly documented everything and reviewed all the underlying documentation, always having title insurance, always having property insurance, using reputable title and escrow companies. You know, together, you know, we made nearly 600 loans together. I think you learn all those steps that are required to make sure you're making good, sound investments.
Okay, let's switch gears. Why don't borrowers just go to banks? You're talking about borrowers who are paying 8.5%, 9.5% rates. That's about twice what a bank would charge if somebody had a loan from a bank or something in that range. So why aren't these borrowers going to banks?
And it's probably one of the most common questions we get from investors. You know, I think if you're in the business and, you know, since the housing crisis, there's just been a substantial pullback from banks participating in any non-owner-occupied mortgage financing. They don't want these types of loans on their balance sheet. Regulators have tended to frown on them. And the market has moved from where, when we first started making loans, it was primarily, you know, REOs. It was at a, you know, the escrows were longer. You know, today's market is very competitive. Good opportunities don't sit in the market long. Oftentimes they happen off market. And our borrowers really rely on us for speed of decision making, speed and certainty of execution. And they are comparing our debt rates with the cost of equity. So even at 8.5%, 9.5%, the cost of debt is so much less than the cost of equity on these investments. It's really the difference between getting a deal done and not getting a deal done. And, you know, although the rates have come down a little bit, when Jan first started the first fund, I think the rates were in the 11 and 12% range. There's still a strong, strong demand from borrowers in the, you know, 8.5% to 9.5% range for this type of financing.
Okay. When the fund started, it was servicing the foreclosure opportunistic investor business, but foreclosures are mostly in the rearview mirror now. So what is the market today? Is it a temporary opportunity or is it a durable opportunity and why?
Yeah, and I think this is a question, you know, you and I have probably both developed our thinking on over the last few years. I think the durability of the opportunity has really changed as the, you know, as the buyer, there's just a very big disconnect between supply and demand in a lot of these markets. California has a lot of unique characteristics as a real estate market. There's a tax law here called Prop 13, which really encourages long-term home ownership. But what it also does is creates a lot of homeowners in very desirable markets who don't necessarily have the liquidity to maintain their homes and to keep them updated. So what we've seen is that the most experienced and successful real estate developers are really turning inward. They are redeveloping urban markets where the existing improvements on the lot are suboptimal. And that could be size, that could be features and functions. But, you know, the best sort of play that we see our borrowers do is buying an undersized home on a lot and adding square footage and improving the floor plan and bringing the features and benefits of the home up to what the current homeowners would want. And, you know, they can spend $150 to $250 per square foot. In a lot of our markets, homes sell for $600, $700, $800 or more per square foot. It's a very high margin business. And I actually see it as a generational shift. I see a 10 to 20 year or more handover of these long-term homeowners. Much of California was built post-World War II, especially where we're at. We look out from our office. Most of these homes were 1945 to 1960 construction. And a lot of them have not changed over that, you know, 50 to 75 years. So I see a long, long-term window for what we've been doing. And I see real estate investors continuing to profit from this, you know, this opportunity in the market.
So you're saying you think it is a durable opportunity?
Very much so.
What if we go into a downturn where home prices are falling? Do you expect that to happen? And how are you positioning to keep doing what you do in that market?
Well, certainly we've seen a tremendous run-up in many coastal markets over the last 4 or 5 years. There's markets now that are at or above the peak pricing pre-crisis, especially up in the Bay Area. So I'm certainly not bullish that we're going to continue to see significant home price increases. I think, again, knowing your markets, individual pockets, is very, very important, not taking a broad stroke to cities like Los Angeles or San Francisco. But I see scenarios over the next 1 to 3 years where this market is, you know, could go flat, maybe even down a little bit. But I don't see anything on the horizon that would indicate another 20, 30, 40% decrease. Most importantly, because credit underwriting is tight, down payments are very high, and today's home buyer in coastal California is not, it's not the 100% financed borrower with self-reported income of the previous housing crisis. Today's buyers are they're well-heeled, they've built up a down payment, they go through a very rigorous credit screening with mortgage companies to get a mortgage, and there's significant job growth up and down most of coastal California. So I don't see a continued jump in prices, but certainly I see prices moving along, at least at the levels they're at, not bouncing upwards. To your question of if there is a significant decline, you know, certainly, you know, we would be you know, our borrowers would be buying properties at significantly lower prices as prices go down. We would likely pull back our leverage and reduce our risk, you know, in a portfolio of, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 different loans. You know, we believe we could continue to produce good income. There is repurposing. Many of these homes would also have an opportunity if they were unable to sell them. They could rent them out or have enough equity. They could refinance us out if they needed to. So, and again, I think in any market that's declining, you just need to be more and more careful about underwriting values. We never underwrite price appreciation. We're looking backwards, not forwards. And we would probably continue to cut that leverage back further and further, you know, to protect our position.
Okay. We're a little past halfway, probably approaching two-thirds, and I'm going to pause for two housekeeping items. First of all, I would really appreciate if somebody would text me with a question so that I know that you're out there and I know that we're on track with the type of topics that you want. So text me at 310-428-9109. Give us one question that way. We think we'll be able to unmute the phones at the end to take questions that way, but there's a slight chance that we would have a technical problem. We tested it before and we think it's working, but I want to make sure we're getting the text. Secondly, on the subject of the generational shift you were talking about and the durability of the strategy, ERICSA does have a white paper available, and please email Dana or myself and we will get you a copy of the white paper talking about ERICSA's position about why this is not a temporary opportunity. So moving on, we were talking about defaults, and out of every 100 loans you make, how many of them become real problem loans? And now walk me through a heavy downturn in the market. How many of those 100 do you think would become problem loans in a substantial downturn similar to the last downturn?
Yeah, so there's a couple levels of problem loans. So obviously one problem is simply a borrower struggling to make their payments. They're in and out of delinquency. They fall a little bit behind. You know, certainly that happens in a portfolio of 100. You're going to see that happen, you know, three, four, five times. For the most part, those borrowers tend to get caught up and, you know, the loan actually ends up performing in the end. You know, out of 100 loans, you know, today we've seen about one that would end up going through default, and we could end up taking it back. Again, that is the worst case scenario from a loan perspective, meaning we had to actually use our perfected collateral and actually take the property back through an auction, in order to protect our interest. You know, in a significant downturn, we obviously want to get the property back and sold as fast as we can before a market deteriorates. We need to protect the collateral. We also, on our loans, get personal guarantees from our borrowers. In part, that keeps, you know, the borrowers, you know, in line, cooperating, working with us if something goes really wrong. If we needed to pursue other assets outside of the collateral in order to protect our interest, we can do so. But, you know, again, I think, you know, in a significant downturn, that one out of 100 could certainly grow to be 4, 5, or 6 out of 100. Mm-hmm. And again, the challenge there is making sure that we've got enough collateral and enough margin of safety that even in a declining market, we can take back our collateral and be able to get back our principal and the interest that's due to us.
One other question you can just answer in a word. How much extra time does it take to manage a non-performing investment versus a typical performing investment? If you had to say twice as long, three times as long, 10 times as much time?
20.
20 times. So I was gonna guess 40, but we'll
You're highly motivated to not make bad loans just from that perspective alone.
That's true. So let's talk about some questions we got from the listeners. Are these loans recourse or non-recourse?
To date, all the loans are recourse loans.
What about your competition? Is your competition recourse or non-recourse?
It's a mix. There are a number of lenders primarily doing lower leverage loans than we do who do not require recourse. There are some lenders who provide limited recourse, maybe 10 to 30% of the loan amount. Our primary competitors in this market who provide similar leverage, they're primarily backed by large institutional investors who use, you know, bank leverage and other forms to enhance the returns. for the most part, those competitors today do require full recourse. But we do. We see the market opening, you know, after a long, long history and experience, borrowers start to see if they can release that recourse. And I could see the market getting to a point where if somebody has substantial experience with us, we may not always be able to hold them to full recourse. But today we do.
Great. I have a question here about what does recourse mean exactly? And recourse means a personal guarantee. So recourse means that the borrower is agreeing to pay back whatever is owed, whether or not the property sells for a sufficient amount of money to pay back the loan. They'll pay it back from other resources if they have to.
And usually banks are always requiring recourse.
Banks are recourse lenders.
Right.
So I did have a question about the minimum investment in your funds. However, I want to remind everyone that this is not meant to be a pitch for the company or any particular fund for this call or any of the calls in this series. So I think I'd like to defer that question to a follow-up after the call. Of course, we are delighted if people discover Arixa's funds through this process, but we want this to be actually educational. So let's talk about the competition a little bit more. How has the competitive landscape changed for you as a lender in the last year to 2 years?
It's really changed substantially. When we first started doing this, it was mostly what I'll call very mom-and-pop, small local real estate investors who would make loans to these types of borrowers. Over the last 3 or 4 years, much as it's happened in the single-family home space, very, very large real estate investors, some of the world's largest, Blackstone, Oaktree, just to name a couple, have become active participants in the space. So we see much more institutional flow. We've seen sovereign wealth, large family offices, and very large private equity real estate firms participating who have very large origination goals, wanting significant scale, and have certainly pressured both rates and leverage in our core markets. In some cases, we've lost borrowers to rates and terms that we were unable to match. We've tried to hold the line there. But the competitive landscape has changed significantly and really forced us to build a better mousetrap for our borrowers, really focusing us on how we provide service, how we deliver our solutions, and really being a relationship-based lender. We try to provide sort of a white glove service that the other larger firms simply don't have the ability to do.
Okay. Now we're pretty much at the end of our 20 minutes, but we have taken some questions from the audience. This is great to have gotten some questions on my text, but we're going to try to open it up. Why don't we try to open it up for questions on the phone now? And while Dana does that, I'm going to ask you.
All callers are unmuted.
Okay. Fantastic. So at this point, let's go ahead and open it up for questions from any caller. Go ahead.
I have a question. My name's Larry, and what happens if there's an earthquake?
It's a good question, Larry. So obviously, one of the things we don't want to do is concentrate all of the real estate in one particular geographic market. Our portfolios tend to be pretty diverse. You know, we're kind of from Sacramento to San Diego. We try to keep it as diverse as we can. We have about half of our portfolio across the LA County basin, you know, which stretches, if you know the market, you know, 40 miles by probably 20 miles. But, you know, it's pretty expensive to have earthquake insurance on an individual single family property. But, you know, the best we can do is, you know, I think a lot of the loans are in very valuable coastal land. So there is value in these properties. So an earthquake, unless everything fell into a, you know, kind of fell in, you'd have damage. But I don't think you'd have sort of the wide-scale wipeout that you might have in a hurricane on Miami or something like that. It's just the actual real estate tends to be pretty diverse, even in within the city of Los Angeles. But, you know, it's certainly something you think about living out here.
Another question that came in via text is, have you ever had to collect on a personal guarantee?
To date, we have not. In the years we've operated, we've been able to satisfy the loans through the foreclosure. There's certainly opportunities that we may have to do so in the future, but to date, under the funds, the ERISA funds, we've never had a loan that's not been able to return the amount that we invested plus the interest that was owed to us.
Okay. We have about five more minutes, so let's take more calls from people on the line.
This is Larry again. On one of the funds, I understand there's, it's called the leverage fund, where banks are involved to get more collateral. Are they, when the banks lend to ERISA for this leverage fund, are they putting first position and we're in second?
No, so basically the way the leverage works with the bank, which we've kept pretty low today, it's about 25% of the fund's assets, is we're basically pledging collateral that allows us to then draw that collateral down and make additional loans. So high-level math is we borrow, you know, somewhere around 4.5 or 5%, and we're lending out at somewhere around 9%. So that's what allows our levered fund to produce 2 or 3% more return than our unlevered fund. So basically, if you think about the margin of safety for the bank's leverage to come into play, the fund would have to burn through an awful lot of capital before the bank would unable to be satisfied. So, you know, we do think about that risk, but we've kept the leverage quite low. The debt coverage ratio is extremely high based on what the monthly interest is. I mean, I think we're at 12 times current debt service in the fund. So we've tried to keep that pretty low, and it's just a way to provide some return enhancement. It also helps us to keep our fund very, very efficient. We don't have to leave a lot of cash uninvested because we can just reduce our debt and try to keep that cash as invested as possible.
Good question. How about another question? If anybody will volunteer.
I hate to hear silence, but I just wanted to say I can't think of any. This is Louie calling and listening and soaking it all up. So floor's open.
Okay. Thanks, Louie. Anybody else?
Yeah, my name is Mark, and I was asking about on one of these slides that came with this webinar is a point number six on where the residential housing cycle is going, and you say that the market has not reached peak, but continued HPA likely limited with downside risk now visible in certain conditions. Can you just elaborate a little bit more on that? What?
Yeah, where's the market right now?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of risk in the market when you think we've got an election coming up in a couple of weeks. You're going to have, you know, a new government in place that may have some different policies. I worry a lot about mortgage credit and obviously interest rates. I don't see a catalyst to a significant increase in rates, but certainly in California markets where the median price is $600,000 to $700,000, you know, you could run into issues of home affordability. The other thing, just holding people back, you know, the Wall Street Journal today talked about 2015, the lowest level of first-time home buyers in over 30 years. And it's very difficult for that younger millennial buyer, which is such a big part of our population, being able to buy homes. So I think there's, you know, those kind of factors, you know, plus just global political fears that exist in the world today are all things that, you know, make me nervous. And the stock market makes me nervous. We have stock market and bond markets at, you know, approaching peak prices, and certainly that impacts people's wealth, sense of well-being, ability to make down payments, things of that sort. So those are all conditions that, you know, I think are going to, you know, could temper any sort of price increase.
Okay. How about one or two more questions?
This is Louie. I did think of a question. The way you manage the funds regarding how ERISA makes money, I believe you said that the fund, the borrowers usually pay a point or two upon the origination. Is that required? What if a borrower says, listen, I don't want to pay a point? What does the interest rate go up? I mean, do you have any borrowers who don't pay points?
We do not, Louis. So the business model and the private lending model is pretty well established. There's always an origination fee. And then, you know, we're looking at a total annualized return. You know, we're trying to hit somewhere between 11-12% APR between the rate and the points. We wouldn't make a loan without charging origination fees.
Okay.
I think we're at 30 minutes, so I'm going to ask for one more question, and then I'll make a brief announcement, and we'll wrap it up.
This is Peter. I have a question.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm just curious in terms of the borrower, if someone has got some cash in hand and good credit but can't really show income, are there still possibilities and things to do with specific property in mind? If, you know, if you're holding a couple $100,000 in cash, like I said, good credit and everything but can't show income.
So the question is, do you require the borrower to have income on their tax returns or otherwise, or are you really lending based on the borrower's cash available to do the project?
Yeah.
How much do you weigh their income the way a bank would?
Very little. Most of our best real estate developers are, you know, quite adept at minimizing their taxable income. We do care about liquidity, where the cash is coming for the project, the collateral, the track record experience. But a lot of our borrowers have substantial net worth and very little taxable income. There's just a lot of benefits under the tax law. We've heard a lot about that from Donald Trump in the past few weeks, but there's a lot of ways that our developers do not generate a lot of taxable income on the returns and still are fine borrowers.
Okay, this is terrific. With that, I'm going to – sorry, was there another question?
I was just going to follow up on that, Greg. So if I'm interested in doing some business with you, just reach out to me through the email.
Yeah, please. We'd be happy to talk to you. Happy to be a resource for you for, you know, projects you may have to take. Yeah, pretty flexible as it relates to the lending standards on income, as long as the other things are in place.
So our next webinar is Wednesday, November 9th. It's entitled Good Things Come in Small Packages. And I'll be interviewing Ellen Snyder, who manages a fund that invests in a number of different income-oriented strategies. It's a fund of funds, and he has spent a lot of time thinking about the niches where you can earn a lot more income today than what you can get from a bond portfolio. And he has a substantial career as an investment manager, and we'll be explaining why he put his own money into this basket of strategies. So thank you, and we look forward to having you on future webinars. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There is one moderator and 25 participants on the call. This call has been recorded.